The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, some of you listeners might remember the cover on the Trumpet magazine from back in January 2014. It pictured America's gravestone, and it asked this question with the headline, "What happens after the American superpower dies?" What happens? We said in that feature that the era of the United States was over. And so, as we asked 2.5 years ago, what happens next? Where do we go from here? Where do we go with this era of the United States now over? Well, if you happen to be one who is watching world events, you're now observing life in the post-American world. Look at what's happened just since that headline. Just in the past couple years, just in the past 2.5 years, 2 or 3 years. It was just 2 years ago that Russia dismembered Ukraine. Forever changing that region of the world. And, of course, you look at all of the turmoil and the violence and the instability in the Middle East, North Africa, Europe. Ann Applebaum had a piece today or yesterday at the Washington Post headlined "The Disastrous Non-Intervention in Syria." And in that piece, she examines America's and Britain's decision not to. Their decision not to act in Syria, that was just 3 years ago.
And today I want to make it absolutely clear to Assad and those under his command, the world is watching. The use of chemical weapons is and would be totally unacceptable. And if you make the tragic mistake of using these weapons, there will be consequences and you will be held accountable.
That's President Obama from December of 2012. And judging by the sound of that comment, well, the era of the United States was far from over. It sounded very strong, a very tough position to take. Telling Assad point blank, you use those chemical weapons, and there will be consequences, and you will be held accountable. And, of course, who can forget the red line that the president drew on Syria. This is clip 4.
We have been very clear to the Assad regime, but also to other players on the ground, that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. That would change my equation.
That was a red line for the United States. The use of chemical weapons, that was a comment from late 2012 as well. And then in the middle of 2013, Assad was caught in the act. You saw the images. We heard the reports. The chemical weapons used on civilians, killing more than 1,300 people in one strike. And the whole world looked to the United States to take action. The whole world was reminded of President Obama's red line statement. And indeed, at the start, it looked as though the United States would act in August of 2013 when it was discovered that Assad was in fact using chemical weapons. This is what the United States Secretary of State John Kerry had to say on August 30th, 2013, this is 3 years ago today that he made this comment.
As previous storms in history have gathered, when unspeakable crimes were within our power to stop them, we have been warned against the temptations of looking the other way. History is full of leaders who have warned against inaction, indifference, and especially against silence when it mattered most. Our choices then in history had great consequences, and our choice today has great consequences. It matters that nearly 100 years ago, in direct response to the utter horror and inhumanity of World War I, that the civilized world agreed that chemical weapons should never be used again.
That's John Kerry from August 30th, 2013, and here's what President Obama had to say the day after that, August 31st.
After careful deliberation, I have decided that the United States should take military action against Syrian regime targets. But I'm confident we can hold the Assad regime accountable for their use of chemical weapons, deter this kind of behavior, and degrade their capacity to carry it out.
But as you'll see in that same address, I'll play another clip here in just a second, the president was already beginning to backpedal because by that point, Britain, the parliament here in Britain, had voted not to take action. It was going to be the United States, a U.S. and British effort. France also was part of this coalition, and they were poised and ready. Judging by the comments from all the leaders, and then the parliament here in Britain voted against it, and everything started to fall apart for the coalition, and the president, President Obama, started to backpedal. Here's another comment from that same statement on August 31st.
Having made my decision as commander-in-chief based on what I am convinced is our national security interests, I'm also mindful that I'm the president of the world's oldest constitutional democracy. I've long believed that our power is rooted not just in our military might, but in our example as a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that's why I've made a second decision. I will seek authorization for the use of force from the American people's representatives in Congress.
Now, he didn't want their input with the strike on Libya previous to this. But now all of a sudden it was important to get Congress involved, and of course what he was doing there was handing it off to Congress. And as we now know, America did nothing. President Obama erased that red line on Syria, and then he handed the mess over to Russia to take care of the problem, and then later after that said that, well, Russia's just getting into a quagmire. They're being reeled into something like Vietnam. I read to you Charles Krauthammer's piece last week, I think it was, about Russia's rise. And he said that when Russia dramatically intervened in Syria, established air bases, launched a savage bombing campaign, and the president of the United States did nothing. It's the post, just as we said in January 2014, it's the post-American world. Krauthammer says, indeed, Mr. Obama smugly predicted that Vladimir Putin had entered a quagmire, some quagmire. And then he goes on to list all of the achievements of Putin in these last few years. Putin's living in a post-American world. Just 2 years ago, he dismembered Ukraine. He's calling the shots in the Middle East. Taking off from bases in Iran. Unleashing savage bombing campaigns. And so Applebaum asks in her Washington Post piece, this is from yesterday, she says, you know, maybe U.S., British, and French intervention wouldn't have worked out so well. Maybe it would have ended in disaster. And if so, today we'd be mourning the consequences. 3 years on, after the United States decided to act, along with Britain, along with France, She says here, but sometimes it's important to mourn the consequences of non-intervention, too. 3 years on, she says, 3 years on, we do know, after all, exactly what non-intervention has produced. And then she runs through all of the effects of standing idly by and not doing anything. The casualty estimates, anywhere from 150,000 to, some would say, 400,000. 400,000 casualties in Syria. 14,711 children killed in the conflict. And then, as far as the ones that have made more headlines, ISIS executing an estimated 2,350 civilians. Thousands of civilians executed, beheaded. 14,000, almost 15,000 children killed. She says in her piece that the life expectancy in Syria has dropped from almost 80 to 55. The refugee problem, that's made all kinds of headlines over the last 2 years. There's 4.8 million Syrian refugees, 4.8 million, and there's an additional 2 million within Syria that are displaced from their homes. 2 million refugees that haven't made it out of Syria yet. On top of 4.8 million, all these women and children fleeing, running, in some cases swimming, trying to find a raft or a boat of some kind. Applebaum says this in her piece, to give some perspective, the refugee crisis caused by the Yugoslav wars in the early 1990s produced 2.3 million refugees, a number then considered to be the worst refugee crisis since the World War II era. Applebaum says the Syrian crisis is three times larger than the Yugoslav crisis. Three times larger. That's what we've seen in a world without America. The post-American world. Look at all of the cities, some of them historical sites going back thousands of years. Aleppo, Basra, Palmyra. All of them devastated. Damascus is, of course, badly damaged as well. She lists off the infrastructure, the roads, the bridges, the schools, the factories that have all been destroyed in the region. And then the destabilization of the region itself, beyond just Syria's borders. Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Egypt. I mean, these are the nations that have taken in the most refugees. We hear all about the problems with the refugees in Europe, in France, in Austria, in Germany, the Netherlands, Greece, Italy. But what about Lebanon or Jordan, Iraq, Egypt? Well, the destabilization in Europe. You know all about that. The hundreds of thousands of refugees that have just poured into Europe, either by boat or crossing into it through Turkey, Greece, and so on foot. The ones trying to get there on boat, according to some estimates, more than 2,000 people, not all from Syria, some from North Africa too. Some 2,000 have drowned while fleeing to Europe just this year. Just in these first 8 months of the year, 2,000. You add that to the other eye-popping figures, 2,350 civilians executed by ISIS, nearly 15,000 children killed, all of the ones that were killed by the chemical attack in 2013, and well, there have been others too. The destabilization in the region, in Europe, The islands off the coast of Greece and Italy that have been overwhelmed by the refugees just pouring in. And then as she brings out toward the end of her piece, Anne Applebaum, the rise of xenophobia across the West. She points to the recent elections in Austria and Poland. All the anti-refugee rhetoric. She says it undoubtedly even played a part in the Brexit vote back in June, right here in the UK. The rise of all the far-right parties, the nationalist parties, even the popularity of Donald Trump. Here's how she concludes. To sum up, physical, human, and political damage on an unprecedented scale, ongoing security threats, the renewed stirrings of fascism. Maybe those are better than the alternative that seems so unpalatable to the British Parliament and the American president, but it's hardly an outstanding success. Well, I think she gives them, Western leaders, that is, Britain and the United States, I think she gives them the benefit of the doubt. But she does do a pretty good job of outlining what non-intervention has produced in these last 2 or 3 years. Now, going back to that Trumpet magazine, January 2014, what happens? What happens, we asked, when a superpower dies? Well, we've seen it in these last few years, but we spelled it out for you, too, in that issue, January 2014. As far as global stability is concerned, America is shrinking to an Albania-sized power at a terrible time. This is what Joel Hilliker wrote at the Trumpet. The Middle East is a terrible muddle. Iran's power is growing. Weapons of mass destruction are proliferating and will end up in the hands of more and more tyrants and terrorists. Islamism will spread in northern Africa. Volatility in Europe will rise, even as Germany's power grows. Contention over resources will fuel increasing tension among European and Asian nations. Arms races in multiple regions will continue to mushroom. This is our forecast from 2.5 years ago. It says here, you can be certain that the number of crises is going to increase. The calls for action, for intervention, are bound to escalate. And because America is no longer the one to step up, the position of dominance is up for grabs, both within regions and globally. It will be ugly. It will be ugly. We are leaving behind a comfortable era of Western dominance, we wrote, and entering a new and uncertain era of violent competition for supremacy among remorseless foes. It's spot on, that forecast. We've talked of late about some of the more recent issues. Go back to any of them. Look at that one from January 2014. The end of the American era. What happens when a superpower dies? Well, we're seeing it. It's all around us. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to send us some emails. We'll get to a few of those later in the program if we have time. Send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jesus Christ prophesied that we are about to enter a time when America's and Britain's global influence will be snuffed out and Gentile powers will wreak unimaginable havoc on the earth. This seismic shift in geopolitical momentum away from America and toward a clutch of non-Israelite Gentile powers, accompanied by an escalation in brutal violence and war, is actually good news, ultimately. It is one of the signs Jesus Christ gave of His imminent return. the darkness and evil that are about to flood this globe presage the most wonderful news in human history. The most recent issue of the Trumpet magazine illuminates this sign, the geopolitical shift in favor of this world's growing Gentile powers. In this issue, the Trumpet looks squarely at where the reshaping of the Middle East is leading. It examines what we can expect a post-American Europe to look like in the time ahead. It exposes how the Asian landscape will be transformed when that continent's native powers return to dominance. It takes an unblinking look at just what this world should expect when the early indications we see today explode into their full scope. It shows how all of these events are already lining up perfectly to unfold in precise accordance with the Bible's prophetic outline. This issue also discusses the hope of physical protection God affords those who put their trust in Him, and the far greater hope of a new world governed by God, which will begin when the darkness has passed. Soon we will look back upon the problems making headlines today and recognize that they were merely, as Jesus Christ termed it, the beginning of sorrows. The time for complacency is past. Visit thetrumpet.com to receive a free one-year subscription to The Trumpet magazine.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Today at thetrumpet.com, there's a feature there on Germany's nuclear future, and it's about the nuclear sharing. As I think most of you know, Germany has had some of NATO's nuclear weapons since the Cold War, and you know, when they were shipped over there initially, at the time some feared that Germany would help themselves to these weapons sitting right there on German soil. And as this article brings out, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Germany pledged back in 1969 that it would never produce any of its own nuclear weapons. But and the nuclear sharing essentially gives Germany these weapons. And then, like is pointed out in this piece, Spiegel brought this out recently, President Obama giving his approval to modernize these weapons now, this nuclear arsenal sitting in Germany. It says here, at thetrumpet.com, some of the new B-61-12 bombs, which will go into production in 2020, will be stationed on the Buquel Air Base in the Eifel region, along with other nuclear bombs. The German Air Force has already begun preparing for the new bombs by ensuring that German Tornado jets will be capable of carrying them. Well, this is an interesting development, is it not? Being that we're in the post-American world, the German Air Force preparing for the new bombs by ensuring that German Tornado jets are able to carry them? And this is what the Guardian Unlimited reported at the end of last year. It says, in non-proliferation terms, however, the only thing worse than a useless bomb is a usable bomb. Apart from the stratospheric price, the most controversial element of the B-61 upgrade is the replacement of the existing rigid tail with one that has moving fins that will make the bomb smarter and allow it to be guided more accurately to a target. Furthermore, the yield can be adjusted before launch, according to the target. The great thing about nuclear weapons was their use was supposed to be unthinkable, and they were therefore a deterrent to contemplation of a new world order. Once they become thinkable, we're in a different and much more dangerous universe. As we go on to point out, that's what we quoted in the piece, Germany's Nuclear Future, posted at thetrumpet.com today. Of course, President Obama is quite confident that Germany can be trusted with these usable bombs. But as he brings out, Josue Mickels wrote the piece, as he brings out, there was a time not that long ago when there were plenty of voices in U.S. government that that weren't willing to trust Germany like this, or Germany's leaders. He goes back and talks about the days of Henry Kissinger, who was highly suspicious of Franz Josef Strauss. And again, Germany's helping themselves to that arsenal. Well, as you know, if you've read our material, if you've read my father's material, Europe's Nuclear Secret, that too is just from, well, I don't have the date here in my notes, but that was, I think, a couple of years ago. A few years ago that we posted that one. My father talking about all these nuclear weapons dotting the landscape across Europe. And they're going to be used. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong said that decades ago. They will be used eventually. That's what your Bible says. That's what Jesus Christ prophesied in Matthew 24, 21, and 22. The piece today, posted today, it says, the time is coming when Germany will use these bombs, and it will not be in the United States' favor. That's what's coming. Great changes are happening, even now in Germany, as I said in the first segment. You look at this refugee crisis and the way that it's impacting Germany. There was a Wall Street Journal piece just the other day about how that now half of Germans oppose Angela Merkel seeking a fourth term. Just a little while back, a few months ago, it was in the 40s, 40%. Now it's half. And a lot of this is brought on by the refugee crisis. A majority in Germany want her to go. This leader, this woman that just a couple of years ago was one of the most popular, if not the most popular, politician in the world. But this is a very different world than it was just a few years ago. This is the post-American world. What happens? What happens when a superpower dies? The Wall Street Journal says pressure's growing on Ms. Merkel at home in a survey published on Sunday. The Bild am Sonntag newspaper said 50% of the people surveyed said they opposed a fresh term for her when the country goes to the polls in October 2017. That's a year from now. It could happen sooner. But even if it doesn't, that's just a year from now. Only 42% would like for her to stand in again next year. Well, it goes on to say how that these marks are higher than they've ever been. Those that want her to step aside. It says here, her popularity has slumped in recent weeks amid mounting criticism of her refugee policy following a series of attacks in Germany. Her popularity, you see, it's really taken a beating. I covered on this program just a week or two ago how that the Germans are now being advised to stockpile food and water in anticipation of the next massive terrorist attack. Well, Ms. Merkel's yet to announce whether or not she plans to seek re-election. I suppose we'll hear more on that in the months ahead. In any event, Some very sobering trends to keep our eyes on. One of our listeners sent me this piece from Fox News this yesterday. Fiscal crisis warning as deficits rise. Debt set to hit $20 trillion next year. Which of the two U.S. presidential candidates have brought this up in any of their speeches? The answer, none. It's not even an issue. It's not even discussed. $20 trillion. The fact that the debt has doubled, more than doubled, under the watch of President Obama. And here you have the Congressional Budget Office sounding the alarm. This staggering level of debt. And it's virtually disappeared as a campaign issue this year. Who talks about it? Who cares about it? Who says anything about it? We're headed, as this article says, it's from Fox News, we're headed to a full-blown fiscal crisis. That, according to Washington, D.C.'s budget scorekeepers, a fresh estimate from the Congressional Budget Office projects this year's deficit, the annual budget shortfall, will spike to $590 billion. That's the deficit for 1 year of spending. Well over a half a trillion dollars. Half of a trillion. I should have pulled this soundbite. Well, I don't even know if it's on a soundbite. It's from President Reagan from 1966, I think it was, when he was voted in as the governor of California, and he comes in, and they're underneath this incomprehensible level of debt. Even back in the mid-1960s, just a mess economically. And he came in and told the people of California point blank, look, there are those who say that there's just no simple answers to this problem. The problems are too complex. And he said there are, in fact, simple answers. They're not easy answers, but they are simple. And the simple answer is the outgo can't be more than the income. In other words, don't spend more than you take in. That's where we start. Now, that's not an easy answer for a politician to accept, but it's the only answer. It's not that complicated, is it? But how revealing is it, these figures? $590 billion more than we took in 1 year's time? Just spend, spend, spend. Even as we withdraw and retreat abroad, even as we enter into a post-American world, at home we're just raiding the treasury until the whole system finally does collapse. This piece here says the debt would then soar over the next decade and beyond, leading to serious negative consequences. But that's just a ho-hum story in this presidential election cycle. There's plenty of other things to talk about. Who lied or who cheated? Whose emails were discovered? Who's mean-spirited? Who's liberal? Who's conservative? Who's the second coming of Reagan? Who's not? Who's a crook? Who's honest? Who's telling the truth? It's a non-issue. $20 trillion. Well, over here in the UK, Melanie Phillips had a strong piece today on Theresa May. Her equality plans are a recipe for injustice. She's caught up in the thinking of so many leaders in the United States as well. Theresa May, it says, her launch of an equality audit has drawn a largely approving response. Her instincts are undoubtedly decent. She wants to be fair and inclusive. What's not to like? Well, rather a lot, Phillips says. The Prime Minister's core assumption is that there is something fundamentally rotten in British society. Her new audit, she says, will expose difficult truths about racial disparities. Here we go again. Racial disparities. The aim is to give every person the ability to check how their race affects the way they're treated by public services. And here again, the truth, if you care to know it, is that you'd be hard-pressed to find any nation better than the United States and Great Britain when it comes to racial equality. That's just the truth. Now, you know all about the voices in the United States. The football player over the weekend, for example, that wouldn't stand during the national anthem. And the outcry, he got a lot of blowback from that, but he's also got a lot of faithful support from the news media, from the Black Lives Matter movement, from a lot of intellectuals and academics that are on TV saying all of the black athletes should do the same because of these inequalities, because of these injustices. And here they are, well, in the case of that football player, making millions of dollars a year in the freest nation on earth. Imagine that. Well, you don't have to imagine it. It's reality. He's in the freest nation on earth. But never mind truth. Melanie Phillips says here, the notion that Britain is intrinsically prejudiced and discriminatory is grossly unfounded. This audit, moreover, won't reveal how people are being treated. All it will show is the outcomes they experience. The aim is to enable people from different ethnic groups to discover the likelihood of their being unemployed, detained, under the Mental Health Act, arrested, excluded from school, and so on. She says, finally, Mrs. May seems to assume that any differences in such outcomes must be society's fault, and so it must put them right. Melanie Phillips says this is a false deduction. Many, if not most, of these disadvantages arise from the circumstances or behavior of each particular group. Well, that's the little-known truth. What's not to like about these policies, she asks. Well, there's a lot not to like. It's ripping apart the social fabric of our societies, of our nations. This piece by Jonathan Tobin, speaking of that football player, Kaepernick, it says, Kaepernick's willingness to buck the patriotic atmosphere, this is at Commentary Magazine, to buck the patriotic atmosphere that generally prevails in the sports world, came the same weekend that pop star Beyoncé used her performance at the MTV Video Music Awards to make something of the same point. During her routine, her backup dancers were portrayed as angels, shot down by police. So here goes Beyoncé with another concert, just like what she had in Glasgow up here in the UK a few months back. Well, Jonathan Tobin goes on to say how that, you know, you can just kind of brush aside these comments or these routines by celebrities and say, well, that's just what celebrities do. Who cares what a quarterback or a famous singer is out there distributing? Well, he says those who follow the news closely understand that most of the talking points about the oppression of African Americans put forward by Black Lives Matter that were echoed by Kaepernick have been debunked. Those talking points put out there by Black Lives Matter, they've been debunked. And Kaepernick's out there ignorantly repeating them. But none of this, Tobin says, none of this has had much impact on the willingness of celebrities to echo the claims of BLM that America is a nation that oppresses black people and people of color. That's what Kaepernick echoed in his exchange with the news media. Tobin concludes here, logical arguments don't really matter when the culture starts accepting something false as being true. So while the notion Kaepernick is championing that America is a place where blacks have no freedom is as risible as it is illogical when it comes from the mouth of a multimillionaire living in a country run by another multiracial person who identifies as black, it is irrelevant if our most popular singers and even some famous athletes are willing to claim it so. Myths, myths that are relentlessly promoted have a tendency to prevail over the facts. That's the great danger here. As Tobin brings out, the fact that they're just being relentlessly promoted and repeated, never mind the fact that they've been debunked. It's just nonstop. And so we'll see now if other sports stars and celebrities follow in the footsteps of those who are out there spreading these false stories, as I covered yesterday, spreading these lies, these myths. Well, you look at some of the other headlines from just today, this Chicago Tribune piece. August, most violent month in Chicago in nearly 20 years. And so we've had an explosion of crime in our big cities following this attack against law enforcement, following the war on police. The Baltimore Sun reports that Baltimore reaches 200 homicides this year. 200. We're only two-thirds of the way in. So Baltimore could be up over 300 by the end of the year. You know Chicago will be. That's the reality. So much of it black-on-black crime. And law enforcement officers, policemen, who are going into those danger zones to try to protect people, to try to help the community. They're the ones under fire, both figuratively and literally. They're under fire. And you can see why now, that they're hesitant to go in. What are the facts that we should be facing? What are the answers to these problems? The leading intellectuals would say, well, there's no easy answers. I mean, these are complex situations. We've got to have some major investigations. The Justice Department needs to step in. We need to hear from the president. More sports stars need to step up and sit down during the national anthem. We need more celebrities to speak out. But what does that solve? In fact, it makes matters worse, as you're seeing. Look at the facts. Look at the cities. Look at the violence. Look at what our major cities are turning into. War zones. There are answers, and the answers, to paraphrase Reagan from 1966, the answers are simple and straightforward. They're just not easy. It's easier to accept lies. It's easier to swallow propaganda. Look at what so many of the people, whether in the Old Testament or the New, look at what they said to God's servants, to God's prophets. Look at what they said to the prophet Isaiah. Don't give us the truth. Tell us smooth things. Tell us what we want to hear. Tell us that our grievances are legitimate. Tell us that we're right about this. We're right about all these problems that we see. Don't say they're imagined. Don't come to us with your so-called facts. Preach smooth things. Look at what Paul said to Timothy in what was it, 2 Timothy 4? Where he said to him, preach the word. Preach the word. Give meat in due season. Give them God's truth. Give them God's perspective. Tell them what God says. And don't listen to those who would come and say, well, we just want the smooth things. Our cities are breaking down. Look at this world. Look beyond America's borders. You see a world in the post-American era. And then look at the trouble facing the United States and Britain. I want to circle back here with this last piece to the Middle East. Because in the midst of all of this turmoil and chaos in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Turkey, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Libya, well, you have little Israel, and it's been somewhat quiet there in recent months, because the region's on fire. Everywhere outside of Israel, it's on fire. But as we've said so many times before, Jerusalem, that's the powder keg. Watch Jerusalem. Keep your eyes on Jerusalem. We're coming up to the end of the Mahmoud Abbas era. He's now in the 11th year of his 4-year term, by the way. And finally, it looks like the Palestinian people are fed up. Israel's fed up. The international community's fed up. Carolyn Glick, she writes, just yesterday, like it or not, the day is fast approaching when the Palestinian Authority we have known for the past 22 years will cease to exist. PA leader Mahmoud Abbas's U.S.-trained Palestinian security forces have lost control over the Palestinian cities in Judea and Samaria. His EU and U.S.-funded bureaucracies are about to lose control over the local governments to Hamas. And his Fatah militias have turned against him. All of this fighting and maneuvering is taking place against the backdrop of the encroaching PA municipal elections scheduled for October the 8th. That's just a month away, a little over a month. Hamas is widely expected to win control over most of the local governments in Judea and Samaria. Hamas's coming takeover of the municipalities is likely playing a role in decisions by Fatah terrorist cells to reject the authority of the PA. Well, just to paraphrase some of the other, she's wondering here aloud if Abbas himself will call off the elections or if Israel's going to intervene and call off the elections or postpone them. I mean, that could happen, as she brings out. But it is, nevertheless, inevitable. Part of Israel's willingness to let Abbas fall, she says, also owes to its inevitability. Once Hamas wins the elections and takes control over the local governments, Abbas's already weakened position will become unsustainable. As is already happening in towns and villages throughout the areas, Fatah cells will transfer their allegiance to Hamas. The areas will become Balkanized and radicalized still further. She says, finally, confrontation between Israel and Hamas-controlled Palestinians in Judea and Samaria is inevitable. It's inevitable. And so we want to be watching Jerusalem. We want to be watching little Israel. And we want to be watching for events to happen fast, as she says here. This process will likely be rapid. And she reminds us of what happened in 2007 when Hamas took over the Gaza Strip and went in there and started throwing Fatah men off of tall buildings and took over the Strip in a matter of days. It happened overnight. She says, so this seizure of control over Judea and Samaria, that's the West Bank, it'll happen in the blink of an eye. And so what does this do for Israel's security when Hamas controls not only the Gaza Strip, but Judea and Samaria as well? When we come back, we'll conclude with a few emails that have come in, mostly in response to yesterday's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to have some of your emails read on the air, live on kpcg.fm, send those messages to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
For an easy-to-read, information-rich news brief, join the growing readership of The Trumpet Weekly. Now you can enjoy all the top news stories from the previous week condensed into a report combining the commentary, analysis, and reporting you've come to expect from thetrumpet.com sent directly to your email. Subscribing is completely free. Simply visit the Trumpet Weekly section of thetrumpet.com to subscribe by email today.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A few emails here to conclude with that have come in just this week. This first one, I believe, from the Northwest there in the U.S. I catch virtually every spoken word in every program. This comes from a dedicated listener, obviously. And they're spot on, it says, every time. The father of lies is hard at work. I see it. I wonder what's next. Like God says, make a chain. Make a chain. To paraphrase what the prophet Ezekiel wrote, he's responding to what we talked about yesterday with respect to truth and lies. It's, the second one here says to label lying as skillful, a skillful use of language, shows the love of lies. Building narratives is destroying facts. Admiring propaganda is no different than admiring the destructive power of the weapons of Holocaust. It says propaganda is all composed of quote-unquote praiseworthy lies. Pride in lies is part of will worship. The truth does not matter as long as the will of tyrants is done. That comes from one of our listeners as well. This next one from one of our female listeners out there. I'm not surprised by the new normal of lying and false information given out. I thank God every day to have this radio program to get the real truth. Thank you all at Edmund and at Edstone for your perseverance and service to all. It says this is an exciting time to be living in. The end of man's rule and the return of Jesus Christ. Of course, that's the silver lining in all of this. These many problems that we have to discuss and expose and tell the truth about. It is, though, an exciting time to be alive, as she says, because it all points to the end of man's rule over man. This next one here says, if the infamous minister of propaganda of the Third Reich, Joseph Goebbels, was alive, he would be proud of the fact that his deadly tool of propaganda and lies is being developed to a high level of political science of lying and misinformation. He says, both the King of the North and the King of the South are using Herr Goebbels' propaganda. I'm also very sorry to see that our current administration follows the same propaganda paradigm to push through the greatest appeasement of human history. That's the nuclear agreement with the Ayatollahs. Then finally, he says, the Munich appeasement of 1938 is just a type of the nuclear agreement. But this is far more deadlier. And then one last one here in response to the back end of yesterday's show, where we talked about the role of the mother. It says here, thank you for discussing the other major important role in the family as well. It's quite shocking that even though it's clearly evident, people will not turn away from the way that they're headed when it leads to disaster. Human nature must subconsciously probe a choice on whether it's of God's law and literally go the other way. Thank you very much for today's show, and please keep up the good work. Well, as I indicated yesterday, hopefully we can continue with some of our study on the subject of the wife's role, the mother's role. There's quite a few other scriptures that I could bring to your attention that I didn't take the time to get into yesterday, or I ran out of time, actually. So as the week progresses, you can look forward to that and much more. right here on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to send us your emails, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.